Morning. Between the last time I was here and today, my wife and I went down to Brazil and visited an AFS student that we had in our home 41 years ago. We were treated royally for 10 days. But one thing I learned about air travel, not only are the seats tight, but the plane is like an active petri dish of coughs and that, and also as wending our way down the aisle, we had to step around the cans, and it really is a mess. And anyway, I admire those who do a lot of air travel. This past Tuesday in the Houston Chronicle, there was an editorial page cartoon that was labeled Separating Families. And the picture underneath was not of children being taken out of the arms of parents, but rather two groups, one on each side of the square, and each was screaming at each other, and they were separated by large letters, politics. These days, one cannot escape comments on and concern for the state of public discourse in our society. With this month's theme of responsibility, I decided to pick up that theme and look at the way our responsibility as citizens take place in furthering the public good. The public good was once a phrase that used to be quite commonly used. Less so today. The public good refers to the generally accepted ideas and ideals that operate within the society in which we live. Robert Reich, who was in three administrations and has recently published a book, The Common Good, defined the common good this way: as our shared values about what we owe one another as citizens who are bound together in the same society, the norms we voluntarily abide by, and the ideals we seek to achieve. The common good recognizes that we are all in it together. If there is no common good, there is no society. Well, I'm a firm believer that there needs to be a common good among us, and it is frayed today. The newspaper cartoon states, and as the inability of even the Republican-controlled House to set forth an immigration policy points out, but it needs to be noted that there are those who deny the necessity of a common good, who value that individual striving leads to the greatest happiness and virtue. Ayn Rand, for example, writes that the pursuit of one's happiness is the highest moral duty of any individual, and that it's better to base society on autonomous, self-seeking, self-absorbed individuals. For her, the common good did not exist. And I thought that Rand's ideas were pretty much passé, quaint, far-fetched. But her two books, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged, since the late 70s, have gained a surprising popularity. Rex Tillerson, his successor Mike Pompeo, are both firmly in the Rand camp. Paul Ryan of the House requires that his staff read Rand, and President Trump says that Rand is his favorite author. So I begin with today then with a parable written by a UCLA professor, Warren H. Schmidt, on the Vietnam Memorandum Moratorium Anti-War Day in 1969. Now that's 49 years ago, so it's a little dated, but not much. If we think that we live in a stressful, turbulent time, 68 was the year of the killings of King and Kennedy, and over 100 riots in the cities following King's death. with over 42 individuals killed. And Schmidt examined the divisiveness that was tearing our country apart in the 60s and wrote this parable. And he titled it, "Is It Always Right to Be Right?" There once was a land where people were always right. They knew it, and they were proud of it. It was a land where a person was proud to say, "I am right, and you are wrong." For those were words of conviction, strength, courage. No one was ever heard to say, "I may be wrong, and you may be right." For those words of weakness, uncertainty, cowardice. When differences arose between the people of this land, they looked not for truth, but for confirmation of what they already believed. When differences arose between the old and the young, the old would say, "We have worked hard to build this great and prosperous land. We have built marvelous machines that take us wherever we want to go, that do our work for us, that even think. We have gone farther, faster, deeper, and higher than anyone in history. We live better than anyone in the world. We expect those who inherit this good land to build on the heritage that we have given them." These older people were right, and they knew it, and they were proud of it. But the younger people of that land would respond, "We see around us a land that has been befouled and exploited. People starve where food is plentiful. Laws and practices prevent some from having an equal chance to develop and to influence. Noble and moral words are matched by selfish and sordid deeds. Leaders urge us to fight wars to preserve peace, and the fighting does not end. The whole scene is phony and polluted and inhuman and out of control. We want no part of this money-mad establishment." These younger people were right, and they knew it and were proud of it. And a gap appeared between their generations. When difference arose between people of different colors, those on one color would say, "We are working steadily to build a land of justice and equality for all our citizens. We've made considerable progress, but social progress does not come swiftly. Those whom we seek to help and lift can only hurt their own cause when they push and intrude and pressure us. Let them show some patience, and let them use more fully the opportunities that we have already provided. Then we will feel like doing even more for them." These people of the majority were right. They knew it and were proud of it. But those of another color would reply, "We have been pushed around too long and we are angry. We have been confined to a ghetto. Our children's education has been stunted in second-rate schools. We've seen jobs go to those less qualified, while our people are rejected or shunted into menial tasks. We see 1,000 subtle signs that brand us and our children as second-class citizens in this land. We will tolerate lofty promises and meager deeds no longer." These people from the minority were right. They knew it, and they were proud of it. And the gap between the races grew. And so it went in this land. Group after group defined the right and took their stand and upheld their position against those who opposed them. It happened between those who taught in schools and those who provided the funds. It happened to those who gave priority to a strong defense and those who gave priorities to better cities. It happened to those who pleaded for peace at any price and those who argued for national honor at any cost. Everyone was right, and they knew it, and they were proud of it. And the gaps grew wider, until the day came when all activity stopped, each group stood in its solitary rightness, glaring with proud eyes at those too blind to see their truth, determined to maintain their position at all cost. For this is the responsibility of being right. No one traveled across those giant gaps. No one talked to those on the other side. No one listened. The quality of life declined and became grim. Then one day, a strange new sound was heard in the land. Someone said, "I may be wrong." At first, people were shocked that anyone could be so weak and so confused. Then another voice said, "You may be right." The people burst into laughter to hear anyone so decisive and soft, indecisive and soft. But the voice persisted, and some began to listen. They began to listen to opposing and even wrong views. And as they listened, they discovered common beliefs that they had not known before. They even began to see signs of humanity and noble purpose in those whom they once knew only as adversaries. Here and there, people expressed their common desire in deeds. And bright examples of joint action were seen in the land. With each new effort, people's faith in one another grew, and their faith in the future, and their ability to shape their own destiny. They stated these beliefs in a declaration of interdependence. All people are created equal, but each develops in a unique way. All people are endowed with certain inalienable rights, but each must assume certain inevitable responsibilities. For the happiness of all depends on the commitment of each to support equality and difference, rights and responsibilities. In this land, people had learned that the search for truth is never over, that the challenge is always the same: to stop fighting long enough to listen, to learn, to try new approaches, to seek and test new relationships. That particular document was so popular it appeared on the front page of many newspapers across this land. In thinking back on discussions over social and political issues that you've had with others, has the sincerity of your beliefs, the conviction and depth of your knowledge ever had the effect of causing the other person to say, "You may be right, and I may be wrong"? In discussions with others, have you ever said to the other, "You may be right, and I may be wrong"? My guess is that such acknowledgments are rare to unknown. In fact, we may think that we are seeing more of this behavior than in the past with the proliferation of news talks programs. But these cable news shows stage the predictable impasse. A host with two or more talking heads assert and then refute, assert and then refute, assert and then refute. A mindless ping pong match. Who walks away more enlightened than they move than they walked in? Have you ever heard a Republican pause and reflect back to a Democrat that they appreciated their point and were reconsidering their point of view? Or a Democrat acknowledged to a Republican that their own opinion wasn't substantiated by fact as much as by belief? It would be truly an extraordinary moment to witness any break through this conventional stalemate. Why is it so difficult to say we are wrong? Well, I thought three factors might be at work. First, I think that what the writer of the parable said is right. To admit being wrong is seen as our culture not just of having a mistaken opinion, but of being weak. Being confident and strong is a primary virtue. Second, I began to wonder if the 12 years that we spend in primary and secondary school roots us in the pattern of right and wrong. Correct answers get higher grades. Being right affirms and inflates our sense of self-worth. Being wrong can be embarrassing. Getting things right become a primary purpose. And then third, it seemed to me that to admit that we can be wrong is because there is innate defensiveness that rises up in each of us to protect us from being wrong. Chicago marital researcher and psychotherapist Dr. John Gottman called defensiveness one of the four horsemen of the apocalypse in marriage, because it is one of the four types of conflict interactions that predict, in his experience, separation and divorce. However, defensiveness is prevalent in more than just our intimate relationships. Sometimes it's hard not to take things personally. To be accused of being wrong, we quickly, almost automatically, throw up a wall, rebut the statement, accuse the other person of the same complaint. A little bit of defensiveness from time to time won't harm, but habitual defensiveness, permanent defensiveness, is another matter. Do you know of any person who, when criticized, even in the most mild fashion, immediately responds with a defensive comment? There are several reasons why defensiveness is so harmful. For one thing, it closes our minds to any truth in the accuser's point of view. We are also shut off from how the other person really feels. Defensiveness creates a climate of contention, and defensiveness keeps us from taking personal responsibility for harmful actions and intentions. So there are ways that lead us to a sense of, I am right, you are wrong. The therapist researcher I referred to earlier would ask a couple that he had in therapy, would you rather be right or would you rather be happy together? And he wrote that couples would automatically respond with a desire to be happy together, but very quickly would fall back into the defensiveness of arguing who's at fault. It's curious how mightily our thoughts and beliefs defend their territory. Why is it so vital for us to be right? Well, to begin with, if you're not right, then you're indeed wrong, with all the accompanying sense of humiliation and failure. But must it be this way? I remember in a 2004 news conference on the Iraqi war, a reporter asked President Bush to cite an example of a decision that he regretted or an admission of something he did wrong during his presidency. Bush looked completely dumbfounded as he struggled to acknowledge having been wrong about anything. Do you have any regrets about sending troops to Iraq? I mean, do you ever feel that maybe it was the wrong decision? The reporter kept at him. No, I think it was the right decision, Bush said. But he said he regretted the rise of the Islamic State. How difficult it is for anyone to say, I made a wrong decision. Actually, I think that is one of the worst decision in American foreign policy in our history. And we're still living with that. There's another form of defensiveness that I find very objectionable, but very common. It's the not sorry, I'm sorry response. The ubiquitous, I'm sorry you were offended. I'm sorry if your feelings were hurt. In fact, they fall into what we called a passive-aggressive category. You know the person is hurt, you know you did something to contribute to it, but you really don't feel compelled to admit that you were part of the reason that happened. What does it feel like to be a person on the other side when the apology implies that you have the problem? Well, how can we respond? I think there are three. I'm going to have three more points. The first is Viktor Frankl, who chronicled his experiences as an Auschwitz concentration camp inmate in World War II. And he developed a new kind of psychotherapeutic method, which involved identifying a purpose in life to feel positively about and immersing oneself in that outcome. But he said that between the stimulus and the response, there's a space. And in that space, we can choose our response. In our response lies our growth and our freedom. He said that everything can be taken from a person but one thing, the last of human freedoms, to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's own way. And so it seems to me that the first thing that we can do to break out of our own defensiveness, to be able to say at times, I'm wrong, you're right, is to pause and take charge of our own emotions. The second thing I think we can do to broaden ourselves where there's an opposing and obviously wrong opinion being expressed, that instead of responding to the difference which leads to conflict, one can ask the question in a low-key, non-confrontive way, why do you feel that way? Or you might say, well, I can tell you have a lot of feeling about that. Why? Not, why do you feel that way? But to just ask in a normal voice. One does not have to give up convictions to be open to others. And to be open to others means now that there's establishing a relationship between two individuals. The breakdown of interpersonal relations and civic discourse can be overcome when the dynamic of rightness and defensiveness is dethroned. I don't have much hope in the self-appointed grown-ups in our society, those who are elected public officials and those who are the pundits on the television and radio. I think here in Galveston, we can undercut those self-appointed grown-ups that have eluded the supposed grown-ups in our society. We can develop a conversation that shows respect for the individual who disagrees with us. A conversation that recognizes that it is not always right to be right. A conversation that places us on the path to affirm the common good. I wish you well.